The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Good morning, everybody. Happy Wednesday. You're watching Squawkbox with the magnificent Jeffrey Cutmore. And you've got me as well, Steve Sedgwick. So these are your headlines. Apple smashing earnings expectations with all product lines posting double-digit growth and Chinese sales jumping almost 60%. But the stock falls as the CEO, Tim Cook, warns on the chip shortage.
The majority of constraints we're seeing are of the variety that I think others are seeing that are, I would classify as industry shortage.
The big tech blowout continues as Alphabet tops forecast with surging ad revenue, whilst Microsoft also beats the street and sounds a bullish note on the second half.
Morning, Steve. Morning, everybody. Deutsche Bank numbers are due shortly here, with analysts expecting the bank to swing back into profit with the second quarter, despite some trading headwinds. We'll get details on those imminently. We'll also hear in the program from the CFO, James Van Molke, that coming up in about 30 minutes' time. We're also focused, of course, on Santander. The Spanish banking giant reports a 3.6 billion euro first half profit and says it is on track to outperform targets for the year. We'll also hear from the CFO of that bank over the next 30 minutes.
Plus, the luxury comeback continues as Kering almost doubles its revenues. Almost doubles its revenues. Extraordinary. With the end of lockdown restrictions pushing sales of Gucci products up by almost 90%. There's an enormous amount to get through. We've got so many. I kid you not. Some days we're just making this stuff up, but some days there is really a lot of exciting stuff going on today as well. I'm going to start with Deutsche Bank, okay? Now, look, this is a stock which has had a really solid rally this year. It's up 18%, 18.7%. So thank you, team, for showing that. That's exactly the point I wanted to make. But it is a stunningly lowly rated stock in terms of valuation. Despite that rally, it trades on a price to book of 0.38. To put that into European context, that is less than half of the price to book valuation of UBS, okay? So it's trading less than half of UBS, but there is some good stuff around as well. And the fact they've had a rally and they've got a plan to get this out of this. And I'm just going to give you some numbers, okay? And then we'll have a quick chat on this one. Deutsche Bank reports profit before tax of 1.2 billion euros in the second quarter. Net income of 828 million euros with post-tax return on tangible equity, the important ROTE figure. Well, it's 5.5%. Now, of course, compared to European peers, it's not as much as they want it, but it is better than it has been in many ways. The core bank, profit before tax rising 90% to 1.4 billion euros. But there are some issues in here. Any time I see a cost-income ratio of 76%. I say, well, you're not actually reining in your costs as well. And I know this is an area where the bank really wants to concentrate as well. In fact, I believe that we've already had comments from the company. Here we go. The CEO says, we reaffirm our commitment to the 70% cost-income ratio target as well. But quite frankly, even 70% is higher than perhaps is where they want to see it for the group. They've made some ESG commitments, record quarterly ESG financing and investment volumes of 27 billion euros. Net revenues up 7% in the first half of the year to 13.5 billion euros. But there's so much to unpack in there. On a normal day, we'd just go straight to it, but there's so much else. But we will speak to James von Moltke, 7:30 Central European Time. Now, Spanish bank Santander has reported a first half profit of 3.6 billion euros and says it's on track to outperform its profitability target for the year. The lender's bad loan ratio came in at just over 3.2% by the end of June. Now, what is that? Is that an indictment of the bank or the huge stimulus and support we've seen from the central banks? I'll leave that one hanging because at this stage of the cycle, only 3.2% bad loans. Well, I think we can all ask our own questions there, can't we? We're all grown up enough to do that, aren't we? Well, its core tier one ratio hit 12.1%. We will hear from the CFO. In fact, we'll ask him those questions. That is José García Cantera. We'll speak to him also at 7.30 Central European time. Then how are we going to do that at the same time as the James von Moltke? But we're very clever. Anyway, Jeffrey, is it a beat from Apple?
It is a beat from Apple, Steve. And yes, we should circle back to these bank earnings because I think there's quite a lot to talk about. But obviously, Apple beat expectations quite handily. A 36% rise in third quarter revenue was the headline number. Sales topped $81 billion, nearly half of which was driven by a 50% rise in iPhone sales. Revenues from services also strong, such as iCloud and Apple Music, growing by a third to around $17.5 billion, while sales from other hardware came in at over $24 billion. So you'd expect the share price to rise on the back of that beat in expectations, wouldn't you? However, despite the blowout quarter, Apple shares traded lower in extended trading after CEO Tim Cook warned the industry continues to grapple with the chip shortage that will likely impact device sales next quarter.
The majority of constraints we're seeing are of the variety that I think others are seeing that are, I would classify as industry shortage. We do have some shortages in addition to that that are where the demand has been so great and so beyond our own expectation that it's difficult to get the entire set of parts within the lead times that we try to get those. And so it's a little bit of that as well.
Well, across some of the other tech stocks, we also saw strong numbers. Google parent Alphabet popped in after hours trade as the company easily beat earnings estimates. Quarterly revenue coming in at just under $62 billion on the back of this 69% rise in targeted advertising income. YouTube sales were at $7 billion, just trailing Netflix earnings over the same period. But CFO Ruth Porat suggested pandemic headwinds are expected to calm as economies reopen. And Microsoft shares edging higher in extended trade after the company put in a beat on the top and bottom line, with quarterly revenue rising 21% year on year. The tech giant reported growing sales across all units. However, it warned revenue from Windows licenses is expected to dip as the chip shortage hits PC makers. But let's come back to those Apple numbers. Paddy Flood joins us, global sector specialist for technology at Schroders. Paddy, good to have you with us this morning. I mean, obviously, the comparisons were favorable on the year on year, but these were still very good looking numbers.
Good morning. Yeah, they are incredible numbers, really, right? That sort of more than 30% growth at the group level is really impressive, particularly the all-important iPhone franchise, which grew 50%. But you're right to note the sort of after-hours market reaction. And I think it's a function of several things, one being the lack of guidance on the next quarter, the second being the supply issues you alluded to. But the third and I think most important thing really is what the shape of growth looks like as we head into next year. And as we've got sort of more than or close to 40% growth so far this year in the iPhone franchise, and that's a predominant driver of revenue, it's right to start asking questions as to how growth for the iPhone suite looks next year.
Paddy, we continue to ask the question around the maturity of the smartphone market. And quite frankly, we've been asking the question since the days of Nokia and Ericsson leadership. Why do we need to be concerned at this point that iPhone perhaps won't continue at this run rate?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it definitely can't continue at this run rate because 40% growth year on year in an already well penetrated market like smartphones is pretty hard to achieve. And then when we look back at the last year, there are probably some factors that worked in Apple's favor, largely around sort of COVID related tailwinds in terms of perhaps stimulus checks or savings benefits for their customer base, along with the sort of 5G upgrade cycle, which has arguably pulled forward a fair bit of demand from future years. I think on the conference call last night, they did mention sort of record upgrade rates in the quarter. And when you have record upgrade rates, it does sort of reduce the potential for upgrades in the following year and the years after. So I guess with that exceptional growth this year, with those other factors on top, it is right to start to being worried about growth in the next year.
Paddy, we know that the regulatory headwinds are there on the horizon, especially for the likes of Google, the likes of Amazon as well. But where would the regulatory pressure come down on Apple as well? What is the focus there?
Yes, it's a good question. So I think the most acute regulatory pressure, at least in the near term, is around the sort of Apple tax on the Apple Store, which is the sort of percentage charge levied on transactions that flow through the Apple Store. It's pretty hard to get any, as it often is with regulations, to get any sort of tangible data points at the moment. But what we can say is that the direction for those take rates is more likely to be down than up. Any movement on those take rates could have a fairly big and material impact on group level revenues and profits, because the App Store is likely to be a fairly highly profitable and fairly large part of their services business. So pretty hard to get concrete estimate changes as a result of regulation, but that's how I think it would manifest itself.
And the other thing that we're seeing and we're watching, aghast in many ways for many investors, of the actions that are being taken by Chinese authorities in China, which are looking at consumer protections and other issues in the various markets. Can any of this affect the companies that actually make their phones in these countries as well, if we're seeing a raft of new rules coming in from the Chinese authorities looking at their tech sector?
I think it's too early to start drawing conclusions like that. And I think the sort of supply chain for the iPhone has been out of the limelight with regards to what's going on at the moment. And for that reason, I don't see a big issue at the moment. The issue around probably making the iPhones is around those supply constraints that Tim Cook alluded to on the conference call last night, more than anything else.
Paddy, very nice to hear from you. Thank you very much indeed for your time nice and early this morning. Paddy Flood joining us there to talk about Apple figures. Right. Let's move on. Caring sales nearly doubled in the second quarter as the relaxation of coronavirus restrictions helped to drive demand for luxury goods. The French group reported just over 4 billion euros in sales, driven by its powerhouse Gucci, as demand recovers in key markets in Asia and the United States. Busy earnings day today. You might have noticed we'll be talking to some of Europe's top C-suite executives. Later in this hour, in fact very soon, we'll be speaking to the Equinor CEO, Anders Opedal. We'll hear from the CFOs of Deutsche Bank and Santander from 7:30 Central European Time. OMV outgoing CEO Rainer Schiel will join us at 7:45 CET, followed by Smurfit Kappa's CEO, 8:15 CET. Later on, Juliana will speak to the Nissan CEO, Makoto Uchida-san, in an exclusive interview. That's coming up at 11:15 CET. I'm told, Jeffrey, that the podcast is vintage.
Oh, absolutely. If you miss any of those earnings first time round, you always have an opportunity to catch up with the numbers yet again. Make an appointment to listen to the Squawk Box podcast. We'll be back.
Ambition to me is about doing better.
I think ambition creates a pathway.
The best advice I can give someone starting off a career is don't have a career, have lots of careers, try loads of different things.
Talk to people and put your ambition out there.
I don't feel that I've hit peak ambition because it's a learning journey.
CNBC is where ambition meets opportunity. What does living ambitiously mean to you? Hear it from our CNBC anchors, reporters and global business leaders on CNBC.com.
Back back, everybody. Steve, a little secret that I know you're into is how I spent my holiday. My wife had me doing a lot of decorating around the house, which meant that I was putting paint on walls. And she commented, isn't it surprising how expensive paint is these days? Well, I think you could use that term with a lot of things, but it brings me neatly to the BASF numbers. This is the world's largest chemical producer, and they've effectively just solidified that view that we are seeing some price pass-through going on in the chemical sector at the moment. So BASF reporting a better than expected second quarter net profit as it both managed to increase volumes and prices. And that obviously helping in terms of the reported numbers. They've given us a net income line of 1.7 billion euros compared to the 1.4 billion euros expected by most analysts that were polled.
Equinor's second quarter core earnings have risen sharply to $4.6 billion, but the recovery was less robust than what analysts were expecting, apparently. The Norwegian oil and gas, energy major, I think they would prefer to be called these days, said the results were supported by higher prices and strict capital discipline. Let's get to Anders Opedal, who is the CEO of Equinor. Anders, really nice you could join us today. Thank you so much for your time. Look, it was so simple for energy CEOs of past. They just had to get as much oil and gas out the ground as profitably as possible. Now you have to look at all kinds of things, from clean hydrogen to offshore wind to CCS, what have you. How are you managing that juggling act, sir?
Well, yes, as you said, you know, we are now a broader company. We are producing oil and gas, but at the same time, also electricity, and we're looking into hydrogen, and we are working with carbon storage projects. But at the same time, still oil and gas will be our main product for some time. And we are in this quarter delivering solid results with strong performance and high production, despite we are within a maintenance season. So we're trying to keep an eye on all of the markets that we're in now.
Very interesting you said for some time on oil and gas, because I know as well as you do and the industry that the industry wants as much oil and gas out of the ground as for as long as possible so it can pay for that transition as well. Do the government's investors and consumers appreciate the role of oil and gas in the transition?
Yes, we developed a strategy now that we presented last month where we're accelerating our transition at the same time as we are growing returns and cash flow. We will continue to grow in oil and gas. We see a demand for oil and gas still over the next years, and then eventually this will decline. At the same time that we are accelerating our growth in renewables, where we are improving, particularly on offshore wind, where we see we have been an early mover and do have a competitive advantage compared to many others here. So we will kind of balance this with both producing oil and gas, capture the high prices in the market, at the same time investing for the long run with renewables, low carbon solutions like hydrogen and carbon capture and storage.
Very interesting that you should answer my question about government support with an offshore wind answer, because I want to tie those two together as well. Because I know that you've been not bemoaning, but you are very interested in governments opening up a lot more offshore wind capacity. Are they holding you back, governments? If so, where?
Well, not holding us back, but I see that a lot of governments, they announced a lot of targets for offshore wind. And I think they're doing their utmost to bring those targets forward. But at the same time, it takes time to put those out for bid, the concessions and so on. So the industry and the governments needs to work together to see how we can actually accelerate those processes and make more area available to the whole in industry, because you see that for many of these new environmental and climate build backs coming from EU, US, UK and Norway is all about, you know, making more renewables faster.
Anders, just on that point, you're obviously building a portfolio of wind and renewable assets at this point, but you're not alone in wanting to do that. How do you make sure that you don't overpay for those assets when there is currently something of a gold rush going on?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think, you know, we are focusing on value over volume when we are growing in renewables. We have been an early mover into this market. So we have projects now in Dogger Bank, we have Empire Wind, we have Beacon, we also received a contract in Poland. So we have already a big portfolio, and our focus now is to execute on that portfolio so we can be a little bit more balanced on new acreage, you know, depending on the price as well. So we will be quite disciplined in this, making sure that we are not overpaying and that we're able to provide the returns we have promised the market also within renewables.
And you talked about, just coming back to the oil and gas business, benefiting at the moment from the higher price per barrel. What's your interpretation of what we've recently seen unfold in the OPEC negotiations? I'm obviously aware that Norway's not a party to that, but are you comfortable that the OPEC and OPEC Plus union has actually got the right strategy, given how quickly the global economy seems to be reaccelerating? Is there a risk here that these high prices kill off the golden goose too soon?
Well, of course, it's always a risk. But what we have seen over the past year is quite a good of collaboration within the OPEC Plus. There's quite a lot of discipline. There is discussions, but what we have seen that is discipline both in the kind of on the supply side, both on the OPEC Plus, but also on the U.S. unconventional and the build back there as well. So at the moment, we see that there is discipline on the supply side. There's a little bit kind of uncertainty on the demand side is increasing, but we are still in the pandemic and we might see close downs and so different parts of the world, and that could affect the demand. So we are actually expecting that we'll continue to be kind of price levels around what we are seeing, but we're expecting volatility going forward. And we saw that in earlier in July, where the oil price dropped over a few days from $76 to $68. So we will think we will continue to see that volatility, but also that it seems like OPEC Plus is quite disciplined going forward.
Yeah, and just while you mentioned the word discipline, let me just ask you about your business specifically then. How easy are you finding it to really keep down the cost per barrel that you produce at this point, given that we're hearing so much talk of inflation, particularly when it comes to labour?
Well, we have a long-term project portfolio, very competitive portfolio. This is a portfolio we worked with a long time. We've been very transparent with the supplier industry about this. We have secured long-term contracts. We have rigs that we need. We have also the steel we need, and so on. So we're seeing some of these movements in the supply chain, but still we have hedged a little bit against it. And I think the key now is that we need to be, as oil and gas companies, be disciplined, you know, building back to higher supply, ensuring that we involve the supply in industry in a good way, such that we don't get these big ups and downs, particularly oil service companies.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to cnbc.com.
Or join us again on the show with Jeff Cutmore, Steve Sedgwick and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.